Radio City, another edition, this one number 31, and this one comes as Rob Ross and I are awaiting the beginning of Heidi on TV tonight. Rob, how's everything going in New York as the Jets are once again playing the Raiders, and we're looking forward to seeing what they interrupt the game with?
Well, the sad part is you and I are the only ones, unless there's somebody out there with enough foresight and deep-rooted intellect in our age bracket, who not only is listening to us, obviously, but who will understand that reference.
Yeah.
If you don't know what the Heidi game is, look it up. It's on Wikipedia.
Right. And the greatest thing about that is that the reason the Heidi game happened in the first place is that so many people were jamming the switchboard to find out if they were going to cut away from coverage of the game to start Heidi on time, that the guys who were the network executives who were trying desperately to tell them not to couldn't get through.
How predictable of networks. But this is what happens pre-cable when you are enslaved to CBS, NBC, and ABC.
That's right. That's right. And pre-email as well. And we've got a whole bunch going on to talk about, to discuss on the program this week. And of course, we've got some new music going as well. But we're going to take a look into the past because of all of the times that we've started our discussions with a sad goodbye, this one hits home in a lot of ways, especially for you. Talk a little bit about Grant Hart.
There are a lot of things I can say. That waking up and seeing the news that he had passed away the other morning was an immediate gut punch that knocked the breath right out of me. I can't say it was unexpected, simply because if you saw photos of him over the last couple of years, he seemed to look more and more like somebody who was suffering from a very serious illness. A few months ago, there was what they were calling a tribute show to him that turned out to be, in fact, a benefit and tribute, a surprise where people got on stage and joined him to do his songs. You know, people like David Perner of Soul Asylum and so on and so forth. And I remember one of the people who saw it commented, this of course is on Facebook, this is why sometimes Facebook has validity to it, but they commented on how unwell Grant looked, and somebody said, that's because he is unwell, and I'll say nothing more about it, which was as cryptic as you could get, but that was very foreboding and very, very unsettling. To learn later in the day on Thursday that it was liver cancer was just, you know, no matter what the cause of death was, it's the fact that we've lost someone who was so important to us musically. You know, for those of us who were in that mid-80s American underground, who took our cues from Husker Du, you know, this was a personal loss, and for me, an even greater personal loss, because at a time when I was going through a very, very difficult period, let's put it that way, Grant Hart took the time to be in touch with me to kind of give me words of encouragement. Unbeknownst to me, he had just lost his house in a fire, and his mother had just been admitted to a nursing home. But he still took the time to give me words of encouragement, which I've always appreciated, and I will never forget. So for me, it of course is more of a striking blow. Never mind the fact that, you know, even though certainly when the punchline got going, you know, we were obviously taking our musical cues from Husker Du. I always tended to lean more towards the Grant Hart style rather than the Bob Mould style, simply because Grant was the more poppy oriented writer. In my acoustic set to this day, Never Talking to You Again is still a part of it. I always segue from Don't Want to Know If You're Lonely into my own song, Let It Go, which is a tongue-in-cheek tribute to Don't Want to Know If You're Lonely. So, you know, Grant Hart has always been kind of a very large figure in my musical landscape. But it certainly means that there, of course, will never be a Husker Du reunion. But he was a friend to a lot of people. He was very loved. And most importantly, his music was very loved, with Husker Du and without. Yeah, he didn't get the accolades that Bob Mould certainly has over the years, but it didn't seem to bother him because he thought of himself as an artist
Yeah.
first and foremost. And he wasn't just an artist in the terms of being a singer-songwriter, multi-instrumentalist, because people forget he wasn't just the drummer of Husker Du. He was the guitarist and frontman of Nova Mob, which he formed after Husker Du. So obviously that's where Dave Grohl got his idea to front the Foo Fighters. I've often said, when you listen to Learning to Fly, that is Grant Hart 101. Those were the exact words I used when I first heard that track on the radio. It is him ripping off Grant Hart perfectly, and
Yeah.
I mean perfectly. Nevertheless, Grant Hart was a very talented and gifted visual artist. He was a graphic designer. He'd always done all the graphic arts for the Husker Du records, but he also was a sculptor and visual artist. He was a true multifaceted, multimedia kind of person. But at the end of the day, we have lost him. The world has lost him. I guess if there's any solace in this, is that it seemed over the last, I'd say, year or so, even though he knew that this was hanging over his head, he certainly had a happier life because, from what I was given to understand, a very long time separation from his son was now patched up, and they were in close contact on a regular basis. And Grant had, in fact, gotten married. So he had people around him that he loved and who loved him. And I would like to think that he passed on a happier plane rather than under some kind of sad cloud.
Yeah.
The irony being just the day before I had been sitting and listening to the first streams of the upcoming Husker Du box set that the Numero Group is putting out in November, and listening to the very first recordings that very few people knew existed from 1980-81. We're talking pre-Statues and Amusement, which are included and cleaned up and sound remarkable on this box set, but we're talking about songs even before that, songs that never been heard unless you were at those very first Husker Du shows at the time. And I'd been sitting on Tuesday, late Tuesday afternoon, just listening to this and marveling at it and thinking, God, this gives me such an energy rush, and then to wake up on Thursday morning to such painful news, that just it put such an ironically cruel crimp on it all.
Right. But with that box set out, it gives us the chance to talk a little bit about the music and with a focus on what Grant did, because with Husker Du, as a Clash fan myself, it always pissed me off a little bit that Topper never got anywhere near the credit he deserved for the drumming technique and for the style. And if that's true of the Clash, it's true about 10 times as much with Husker Du, because what he did, Grant Hart always struck me as a guy who was an amazing technician when it came to being a drummer, but he wasn't fancy. He didn't have that, like, that Neil Peart over the top flash, because he didn't need to. But what he did, I mean, you listen to even stuff like Flip Your Wig, and it's incredible. Not only is it technically sound, it's interesting. He was a student of what he was doing.
The interesting thing you bring up there is the fact that, in the grand scheme of things, he wasn't a drummer.
Right.
He played drums much the same way Tommy Ramone played drums. Nobody else is going to do it, so I'll do it. It was default drumming
Yep.
because he was a guitar player and a keyboard player. Dave Grohl, on the other hand, was, he wavered between both, and he was also a trained musician. I don't like to make the comparisons, but you're talking about somebody who came from one band that was known and successful and legendary, came out from behind the drums to front another band,
Yep.
that has, of course, become even more successful, and which I actually like versus the old band. With Husker Du, the thing with Grant Hart is that his style of playing, which was very, very easy to recognize after, if you knew the music of the Huskers, you knew Grant's style the minute you heard it,
Right.
because it was always that heavy floor tom ride cymbal and, you know, just machine gun rat-a-tat-tat drumming, very militaristic. And what you said is very accurate about it being not fancy, which is interesting and ironic considering Tuesday afternoon, just before I had started listening to that Husker Du compilation, I was watching the Minutemen documentary with Jamie Cano, and Grant was being interviewed in it, and he's talking about George Hurley, the Minutemen drummer, who is one of the most unreal drummers you will ever see. Yeah. I mean, he's so amazing and so talented. But Grant was talking in the technical terms of how George played was in a way that no one could ever approximate, and he wasn't even going to try, you know?
Yeah.
But what Grant did in his own minimal style was something that was, in effect, something that you couldn't replicate because it was his own. And with Greg Norton as his rhythm section anchor, it was a perfect selection between the two. Now, the recognition thing, that can be taken as a sore subject in many ways. You know, I have to be honest, I'm a fan of both Bob Mould, let alone Grant Hart solo. If I had to pick one versus the other, I will always prefer Grant Hart's style because it's much more akin to my own style. It's much poppier and fleshed out and Beatlesque. And with Bob Mould, it was always the cathartic, you know, and, you know, I love Bob. I love his voice. I love his style. I love the sound. I loved Sugar because with Sugar, he did and sounded the way Husker Du should have sounded on record.
Uh-huh.
That's always been the biggest beef, but I'll get to that in a moment. The thing is, Bob has always needed an editor. He really just doesn't know where to stop sometimes with lyrics. They just go on too long. So the songs tend to meander more than they should. But at the end of the day, Bob Mould is an entity unto himself. Grant Hart's music, when you know, there weren't a lot of expectations, I don't think, frankly, because of the way Husker Du ended. And I'm not going to get into the whole – I think most people, especially those who probably listen to us, know the backstory of the ending of Husker Du. But, you know, when Grant Hart was the first one to come up with a solo release, which was the 2541 EP, and people heard the beauty, the sheer heartbreaking beauty of the song 2541, you knew, wait a minute, this guy was going to do something great, mm-hmm. if not great things going into the future ad infinitum. The thing is that Grant Hart's solo output was erratic and so much less than one would have hoped and expected. I mean, you had the song 2541. Then later in the year, he put out an album called Intolerance, which I believe was originally supposed to be called Kick a Hole in It. And it had several of the songs that actually had been part of the Husker Du set and would have been part of what would have become the seventh Husker Du album. Two in particular, All of My Senses, and the one that to this day is still my favorite, and one of my favorite songs by anybody of all time, Now That You Know Me, which is so Beatlesque. The thing about Intolerance was that it had this incredible mid-60s roller rink kind of feel to it, you know, that kind of Dave Cortez organ playing.
I was going to say, Dave Baby Cortez, absolutely. Yeah.
Absolutely, you know, there's some really incredible but heroin-laced bubblegum in this. Ironically, there's a very eerie track on there called Roller Rink, you know?
Yeah.
But then, you know, he formed Nova Mob, which unfortunately was sabotaged by the collapse of Rough Trade Records, who, as soon as they released The Last Days of Pompeii, which was Nova Mob's debut album, and had an incredible song called Admiral of the Sea, the record label went belly up and away went the album. If you can find it, good luck. I mean, I got it when it came out. I was very fortunate. So then Grant puts out another album, I think 1999. So we're talking about a 10-year span from Intolerance to his second solo record. When he put out Good News for Modern Man, which is so stunning, I can't even find the words for it. Just the songs that started off, like Think It Over and Run, Run, Run to the Centre Pompidou and You Don't Have to Tell Me Now, which I can't listen to because it makes me cry.
Mm-hmm.
It, every time I've heard the song, it makes me weep. It's that powerful. You knew that this man was truly gifted, and he would sporadically surprise us with something new. The last time he put out an album was the end of 2012, early 2013. a concept record, a double concept record called The Argument, which was based on Dante's Inferno. And the last record, which he just did not get to complete, was apparently about the Unabomber.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, Grant Hart, at least he was still working on things and looking towards the future. And, you know, for me, I'll just always remember him as being that kind of goofy, smiling, hippie-looking dude in the back of a hardcore band, because the first time I ever saw him play was on the Zen Arcade tour in 84. And I just thought, wait a minute, Husker Du can't be hardcore. This fucking guy's got long hair, and the guy up front has a handlebar mustache.
Yeah, right. Well, and that album, Zen Arcade, that's one of those that, again, you get a little bit of everything. You get that sort of experimental pushing out at the boundaries, where is this going kind of feel to some of the tracks. And then some of the other tracks are just, you know, really good, straightforward, heavy pop songs. And there's not a damn thing wrong with any of that.
Well, the thing is, Zen Arcade, and this is what bothers me about this happening as we were planning to do this particular show, because you and I have made reference to Zen Arcade. We've made reference to Double Nickels on the Dime. We certainly talked about Emergency Third Rail Power Trip. And what I wanted you and I to do was to just start an actual discussion slash mini series on the American Underground circa 1984, because that was year zero.
Right.
When everything happened at once. Because as I've often said, there was that one incredible slash miraculous week where everybody released the albums that became absolutely seminal. You had Zen Arcade, Double Nickels, Meat Puppets 2, Let It Be by The Replacements. Reckoning had come out a few, like 2 months before. And, you know, Emergency Third Rail Power Trip had come out right before that. You know, 1984 was the watershed year for American music to truly take back what was rightfully theirs.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? But let's talk about Zen Arcade for a moment, since we might as well begin that jumping off point. And then, you know, as we go along, I'll put in my thoughts about things that happened during that 1984 period. You know, Zen Arcade, which was a concept album of a kid leaving home, you know, that was it was a very gutsy move. First of all, the words concept album in 1984 were, if not unheard, completely still considered obscene.
Right.
Because concept albums were verboten since the 70s, you know. You say concept album, you think Jethro Tull, yes, Pink Floyd, you know, the dinosaurs, so to speak. But for Bob Mould and Grant Hart to conceive of such an album, it was a very personal document from both of them. The thing is that this particular record, like you said, it's got the thread that runs through it, but you also have the songs that are just such great heavy duty pop songs. You also saw the two very distinctive personalities of Grant Hart and Bob Mould become completely separate entities. Because if you listen to the previous Husker Du records, they're either completely unintelligible because they are, in fact, hardcore punk.
Right.
You go back and listen to something like, well, you can't truly listen to Land Speed record because it's 99% unintelligible, being a badly recorded live record. You listen to Everything Falls Apart, and that's hardcore punk.
Yep.
But when you listen to Metal Circus, which came out in late 83, which was kind of the taster since it's an EP, you get the feeling that they're about to do something because the tempos did start to slow down a bit. And right before the release of Zen Arcade, Husker Du took the very ballsy step of releasing a single. And it happened to be their version of 8 Miles High. You know, nobody saw that coming.
Yep.
But that single really put a stamp on things. And I firmly believe if that had come out on a major label, it may have actually made the charts. I think it would have charted.
Yeah.
Zen Arcade comes out, and all of a sudden, the first thing you're struck by is the track Never Talking to You Again. I mean, because here, it starts off with you know, pretty heavy-duty stuff, Something I Learned Today, which is Mould screaming. Melodically, but he's screaming. It's right. I don't want to use the word, but I will, predictable. In the sense of a hardcore band with a reputation already. And Never Talking to You Again comes along, and it's an acoustic song. And you just go, what? Now you're off to the races, because then the album goes off in so many different directions. It's wonderful that there's so much to digest. You know, you've got a track like Grand Hearts Hare Krishna, which is this incredibly psychedelic redoing of the Krishna chant, but with a very tongue-in-cheek bit of lyrical prose thrown off of it, thrown on top of it. You know, you've got Chartered Trips, you've got Masochism World, you've got the free form of Recurring Dreams, Dreams Recurring.
Yes, and that you know, again, they're just an amazing bout of studio work there to make those
60
things.
Minutes.
Yeah,
yes,
I know. Just, but to be, I mean, to give them the sound and the aura that they had was amazing.
But the standout track of all tracks, as far as I'm concerned, and I will argue this to the death, of Zen Arcade, the one that the lights shine on the most is Grand Hearts track Pink Turns to Blue.
I'm so glad you said that. Yes,
poppy as you can get, but the lyrics are so harrowing. And at the very last verse, no more rope and too much dope. She's lying on the bed, angels pacing, gently placing roses round her head. And I don't know what to do now. Pink has turned to blue. I mean, my God, done in the framework of a recurring poppy riff, is this song about drug addiction, overdose, depravity.
Right, and death. And, you know, that one, but it's such a beautiful song. I mean, I could listen to that one anytime. And the other one, we were talking about the drumming and the style and what it added to the music that I really dig a lot is The Biggest Lie. And that's one that, you know, again, it's not showing off, but technically it's one of those holy shit kind of moments where if you listen to that song and just listen and concentrate on the drum track, it's like, damn.
Never mind Bob Mould screaming to the point of, how does this guy even have a voice?
Yeah, but it is. It's an incredible piece of work from beginning to end. And that's the whole point of Zen Arcade, is that it's full of moments like that that just grab you and you go, wait a minute, did I hear what I just heard? And you got to roll it back and listen to it again and again and again.
I'm firmly convinced that if SST, who seemed to never do anything right, if they had done their job better and had more copies out there in the hands of the distributors so they could be in all the stores as the band was on tour, this album would have been so much bigger than the legend that it became within the Tiny framework, because it was almost instantaneously legendary from the time that we had gotten it, simply because I think of that record as being almost the most necessary thing a teenager can have in order to try and get through the pains of adolescence.
Right. Well, and here's a funny story about that album, is that in 1985, because I didn't come into that one until late. I didn't know it was coming. And in 1985, I had my first car, big tail fin job, loved it, and joined a car club. I was in a car club with this guy, Lonnie Buchanan, and he was the one who laid that record on me. And the funny thing about that is, here's this guy who is a born-again Christian, nicely so, by the way. I mean, he's not one of those who's going to try and convert everybody he meets, but he's just, that's his thing. And he's a wonderfully warm guy, and he's in the middle of this little town in Florida called Kathleen that's outside of Lakeland. I mean, it's out in the middle of nowhere. And of all of the people, you talked about it getting better distribution. The way that that album spread by word of mouth and the people that it spread to always fascinated me, because you never knew who you were going to run into who already knew about it. And when you got talking about music like guys do, and you mention that name and you see in a room full of 20 people, you see two or three guys' eyes light up, and you know, okay, you guys are the ones I need to talk to. That's what that album was to me.
That will lead then into what I was going to say, because, you know, it was the early summer of 84. That was at the point where 2 Minutes Hate was honestly getting stale for me. You know, us being the best British band in Staten Island was just not particularly interesting.
Uh-huh.
There, at that point, we found that there were more than enough really bad copyist jam wannabe bands out there to suffice that it became a turnoff. Plus, I was getting my, you know, my REM Jones really running. I mean, by the time Reckoning, forget it. I mean, the thing was is that I had tired of the whole, you know, Suits and Rickenbackers thing, and I had a conversation with Mark, who was our bass player, in which, funnily enough, we were thinking the same thing independent of one another. I want to stop doing this. Yeah, me too. We should do something else. The thing was, when I was about to have that conversation with him, it was the day after we had done our Independence Day gig, right? And this is 1984. And I was waiting for him at the train station, even though he lived a town away and could walk. It was just faster for him to take the one stop.
Yeah.
And I'm waiting at the train station, and I'm reading The Aquarian, which, as you know, is the New York, New Jersey area musician's paper. And that's how we'd actually met originally. You know, you read The Aquarian to either connect with other musicians or to find out who's playing and so on and so forth. And REM were the cover story that week, which is the first time I saw REM as a cover story. And I'm reading, and as Mark gets off the train, I said to him, hey, look, REM's on the cover. He's like, oh, pretty cool. And I said, check this out. This week at the Ritz. And that week was Husker Du.
Mm-hmm.
And it says, you know, they had a little sidebar that said, and don't forget to pick up the new album, Zen Arcade. Right? So you flip a couple of pages, and there's almost like a quarter page ad from SST Records that the new from SST. Husker Du, Zen Arcade, The Minutemen, Double Nickels on the Dime, Meat Puppets, Meat Puppets 2, Black Flag, My War. And that's when I said to Mark, this is where we should be going. As we were having that conversation about putting a stop to 2 Minutes Hate the way we had been. And right there, and I said to him, you know, I think this is where the things should be headed, because first of all, they're all closer to our age than the bands that we're imitating.
Right.
You know, of course, I'm paraphrasing it now to sound a little bit more reasonable. So, you know, you have to give me that little artistic liberty. But I said to him, you know, these guys are more like us. I mean, they look probably like us. In fact, they're probably uglier than we are. They can't get women, neither can we.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think this is what we should be doing, because let's face it, we're not British. This is dumb. And he said, I agree. And so we decided the first thing we were going to do was we were just going to stop dressing the part and just like be ourselves. And so I let my hair grow and just dress. I basically looked at that point, you know, after letting the mod thing die away, looking like I was, you know, cross between Pete Buck and Michael Stipe, you know, because that was what it was comfortable looking like. I didn't have to try. In other words, my hair got long and the first time that we played in this new physical, guys, I was kind of upset and scared, to be honest with you, because I thought our very loyal, small but loyal audience were not going to appreciate it. They loved the whole British thing, and I thought they were going to turn on us for basically looking like everybody else. But boy, that grew the ranks even faster and harder. So we knew we were on to, okay, now we're in the right mindset in the right place. And musically, we got harder because Mark really took to Husker Du. I mean, almost to a religious zeal. I was actually a bit more enamored with the Minutemen because Double Nickels on the Dime was just so much weirder and so much sparse.
Sparsier.
It just had such a width to it, and because it didn't sound like the overdriven, hyper fuzzed punk rock, especially that's going to come out of a three piece.
Uh-huh.
You know, and at that point, 2 Minutes Hate were in fact a three piece because our second guitarist had already left to go to Sarah Lawrence. Nevertheless, it was the Minutemen that really took me, but that will be next week's episode, as we sit, you know, transition and segue from our recollections and remembrances of Grant Hart to the importance of Zen Arcade of being probably the most important album to come out in 1984 and its counterpiece.
Yeah.
Because this album is equally as important, and that is Double Nickels on the Dime from the Minutemen.
Definitely. All right.
Story up next week.
Good deal. All right. So a cliffhanger. And we move to TV because there's a couple of things going on. I don't know if we mentioned this last week or not, but there's a Netflix series that we've become just enwrapped in. And it's called Atypical. It's about a kid who is, I think he's 17 or 18 in the show. And he's on the autism spectrum, and he's decided it's time to start dating. And Jennifer Jason Leigh plays the mom, and the show is just, it's hilariously funny in that not laugh-tracky, jokey kind of way, but just in a very observant kind of way. So there is good stuff happening on TV, and I've also been trying to catch up because my son hipped me to BoJack Horseman, also on Netflix, which if you haven't seen it, is a cartoon about a world where some people are people, but some people are half animal, like horses or spiders or cats or whatever. And life is just like that. You know, nobody thinks anything's weird. And this main character, BoJack Horseman, who is mostly horse, is the failed former star of a 1990s sitcom. And now he's turned into a boozing loser, and it's fucking hilarious. So there is some good stuff out there, but I know you've gotten onto something else.
Yeah, especially in light of the fact that we all had a field day, of course, in this last year with Vinyl.
Blasting it, yeah.
Yeah, well, HBO has a new series, a new period piece taking place in 1971 New York. This one is called The Deuce. And if it's called The Deuce, I was thinking, well, they got another piece of shit on their hands.
I thought the same thing.
But I have to say, and I will grant you, this is only the first episode, but look at how much I, let alone everybody else, hated Vinyl after the first episode. Mm-hmm. First episode, to me, I thought was fantastic. I'm going to take the one complaint that I have, take that first, we'll talk about that, get that out of the way, and then we'll go into why I think this show might actually be a winner.
Okay.
Okay, so this is a period piece. And being a New Yorker born and bred, I watched this with such scrutiny to see any and all possible mistakes. And I found the fragment of just one. And you had to have a trained eye for this kind of thing. There is a scene on the street where the cops are pulling over to talk to a couple of pimps sitting, getting a shoe shine out on the street. And the cop cars, Plymouth Furies, the not black, but very, very, very deep green and white, because very few people ever remembered that they weren't really black and white. They were green and more green than anything.
Yep.
Cop cars of the early 70s, you know, the ugly yellow street signs of New York that I grew up with and so on. But I give a glimpse, and there's a kind of a shot of the street corner. The mailbox is a current mailbox.
Okay. Yeah.
1971, you still had the very the flag colors. You had the red top and the very dark blue bottom half. That's the only mistake I found so far.
Good.
Everything else is a win, right down to the fact that the theme song, the opening credits theme song, is If There's a Hell Below, We're All Gonna Go by Curtis Mayfield.
Sweet.
Ain't that about a bitch? Talk about a motherfucker to open the show with.
Yeah. So what's the driver? What's the action?
The whole premise is built around, I'm guessing, going forward, is prostitution and probably going into porn.
Okay.
We haven't gotten that far yet. But prostitution, pimping, and it's based around twin brothers, both played by James Franco, who I actually like James Franco quite a lot.
Yeah.
I think he's a great talent, and I personally don't think he takes himself as seriously as everybody else seems to want to hype him as being. But this show definitely shows that he's got the acting chops. He plays twin brothers. One is a guy who works as a barman on both sides of the river. He lives in Brooklyn and works in Manhattan and, you know, married to a real whore. So he's dumped her and moved into a hotel in Manhattan. But, you know, he's just trying to make ends meet by working two bar jobs. Mm-hmm. His twin brother seems to owe everybody in New York City money because he's got such a gambling habit. Maggie Gyllenhaal as a hooker who's originally from New Jersey, trying to make enough money to be able to, you know, give money to her mother to take care of her son. But she doesn't have a pimp, so she keeps all the money to herself.
Yeah.
There are a couple of these great guys who play – I don't know who the actors are, but these two pimps that are hysterical because they're so accurate. The one guy kind of reminds me of my old pimp, you know, alter ego. My alter ego was King Biscuit, right. whose tagline was, of course, "Man, that ain't cool." And who had a black man servant named Man X.
Uh-huh, of course.
Kind of the precursor to, you know, Morris Day and Jerome. The time, recognize. There were a couple of little sidebar stories like this very attractive NYU student who at first is having an affair with one of her professors, gets pinched by a very benevolent cop who lets her go after she tries to score amphetamines, and she meets up with the bartender played by James Franco and strikes up what seems to be a friendship. All of this happening in the first episode.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very fleshed out. So you're getting to meet all the characters and what's going to bring them together already, which makes all the sense in the world instead of dragging it out.
Gotcha.
You know, it's like, okay, it's already starting to infuse because there's this one scene where the gambling twin, James Franco, is walking down the street, sees Maggie Gyllenhaal working a corner and says, hey to her. So he already knows her on a first name basis. You know, so these characters are all interwoven, I think, pretty seamlessly.
Nice.
I think it will work. I thought the performances in just that first episode were great. If it was just a movie, I thought it would have been terrific. But it's episode two comes up tonight. So this is a very hopeful we'll see.
Good deal. All right. So be watching for The Deuce on HBO. And we'll have to catch up on episode one. The other one that we've been watching lately, it was one of these limited run series over the summer. And I honestly don't even know what network it's on. It's on one of the cable networks. It's a show called The Sinner. And the Jessica Biel is the main actress in it. And it's a kind of a murder mystery thing that plays out over, I think, 10 episodes. And, you know, Jessica Biel is fine. You know, I'm not one of these guys who's like, oh my God, she's so gorgeous. She's fine. But I think that, Bill Pullman plays the cop who's also very flawed in this series. And he's kind of trying to help her while he's still kind of suspicious that maybe she's just making all this shit up. But it's an interesting mythology. And if it hasn't ended yet, if the final episode hasn't aired yet, it will air sometime this week. So by the time this is up online, it will have already aired. And it's one of those that if you missed it over the summer, it's worth going back and taking a look at because the writing is good. And like you said, the characters are fleshed out. They're not as two-dimensional as what the networks have always given us. And everybody's got problems. And it's not all the same problem either. You know what I mean? Oh, and the other thing about it is the woman who plays Bill Pullman's estranged wife is Catherine Irby from What About Bob and then Law and Order Criminal Intent. And
The Wire. The Wire. Oz.
Oz, right. And sure, I'll watch her.
Terry Kinney and... Yep.
Yeah, put her on screen and I will watch whatever you have.
She's a damn good and I think criminally underused actress.
Definitely. Definitely. And some of the movies that she's done that nobody would recognize the name of are great, and they're these sort of under-the-radar, very gritty kind of stuff. I mean, granted, What About Bob? But she was, I think, 18 or 19 when she did that movie. And so later on, she just made some really interesting choices. She seemed like one of those actresses who was fine just working for a living as long as she got to do neat shit, and she sure as hell did.
By the way, 28-13 Oakland over the Jets right now. Big surprise. Big surprise.
Yeah, well, you know, speaking of football, it was a heartbreaker today for the Bills in a game that between them and the Panthers, they were playing. Oh, yeah, all field goals, and they were both trying really hard to lose that game. Nobody seemed there. Nobody seemed interested at all, and Buffalo had a chance to score that touchdown.
Buffalo just won one game.
Yeah, right. They had
Jets are not.
Well, they had a chance to win it right at the end, and the winning pass went off of the fingertips of a receiver. So, same old story in Western New York, almost.
I am doomed for life to completely follow losers.
Yeah.
The Mets, the Jets. I don't follow the Knicks. I don't give a fuck. The Rangers, on the other hand, who knows? I mean,
they did win.
The problem with the Rangers is, though, they're great at being like the proverbial cock tease.
Yep.
Except I don't trust them anymore. So because I'm wise like that, I don't fall for that kind of shit.
No, but I will be there. And it's funny. I was having this conversation with somebody earlier this week about the fact that in Los Angeles, because the Rams left here. Here I sit in St. Louis, and the Rams left here this year to go play out in Los Angeles. And I don't know what they've been drawing. I haven't been paying attention because, honestly, I didn't pay that much attention when they were here. But I asked a friend of mine who lives in Hollywood. I said, am I right in thinking that nobody gives a tin shit about the Rams in Los Angeles? And he said, oh, yeah. Actually, his response was, the who? So,
I bet they got a bigger heart on for the fact that the Chargers came back.
Yeah, right. Because at least it's a Southern California team. But, yeah, they don't care. And it's weird because when you live in a place where nobody's from there, it's hard because, I mean, when I lived in Central Florida, nobody was from there. It's different now. I mean, there's a lot more natives than there were when I got there, but everybody was from Buffalo and Cleveland and Cincinnati and Chicago, and they didn't come down and become Buccaneers fans. They came down and stayed Bengals, Bears, Browns and Bills fans. That's it.
Well, I mean, look at it this way. Miami Marlins fans, whenever the Mets are down there, most of the people are wearing blue and orange.
Right. Yeah. You want to talk about a team nobody gives a shit about. How about the Marlins?
The thing about L.A. is the fact that, I mean, even to this day, people show up late and leave early for Dodger games.
Right.
Meanwhile, you got people here in Brooklyn opining away for the fucking Dodgers. Fuck them. They left Brooklyn.
And the only reason anybody goes to see the Lakers play is so that they can be seen courtside on TV.
And plus the Lakers have a greater history of winning out in Los Angeles than the Rams ever did.
Right.
Even though, if I'm not mistaken, historically speaking, the Rams were the first to go to Los Angeles. The Cleveland Rams went to L.A.
Yeah, I think so. Before San Diego, yeah. Right, because San Diego wouldn't have been until 1960.
And they were an expansion team, so that didn't count.
Right.
The Dodgers had to come from Brooklyn. The Lakers had to come from Minneapolis.
Yep.
58 or 59.
Right.
So,
which is why it makes sense, because of all those lakes in Los Angeles.
Right, because of course there's so many lakes in Los Angeles. There are so many Dodgers in Los Angeles.
Right.
So many Rams in Los Angeles.
Still and all, though, it gives us somebody to hate on, and rightfully so, because nobody's going to tell us anything wrong. Now,
the only original Los Angeles team with longevity is the Kings.
The Kings, right.
Because the Chargers left after only 1 year.
And I remember when the Kings were in those hideous purple fucking uniforms back in the 70s.
Yeah, the purple and gold uniforms.
Oh, they were so bad. And then, of course, they changed up when they went and bought Gretzky. And I still, it was one of the funniest things Dennis Miller ever said when he was doing the weekend update on Saturday Night Live. And he said, all these people in Edmonton are pissed off at Wayne Gretzky for moving to the Kings. He goes, let me see if I can put this into perspective for you. And he put up a picture of Santa Monica Boulevard and he said, this is Los Angeles. Then he put up a picture of Janet Jones and said, this is Wayne Gretzky's wife. And then he put up a picture of a bicycle frozen to a post and said, this is Edmonton. It's like, what else do you need to know? But it's now on the subject of sports, though, there was something amazing that happened this week. And it happened with a baseball team that never wins and never gets any respect, but now they're record holders.
Well, let's say this. They were last year's American League champions and went 7 games extra innings in the World Series, only to lose to that fucking team from the Windy City.
Chicago, right?
I even said it when they won the World Series that the end of the world was nigh and God help us, Donald Trump will become president because they won the fucking World Series.
Right.
It has been said from on high for years that should the Chicago Cubs ever win a World Series, the planet Earth is doomed.
Yep. Yeah, and now we're looking at going to war with North Korea. Yippee!
And now we've had 2 catastrophic hurricanes.
Yep.
We have bombings in London, acid attacks in Paris. Bill de Blasio is mayor in New York. But the Cleveland Indians – well, first of all, the Cleveland Indians, and I tip my hat to them completely, surpassed the 2002 Oakland A's for – most consecutive wins in the American League. Now, correct me if I'm wrong. Did they tie the baseball record in general?
I think so. I think that's the Major League Baseball record, yeah.
Right. The Major League record was 22. They tied that record this week by winning 22 consecutive games. Irony upon ironies, they lost the 23rd, and then they won again last night, of course.
Right.
The Cleveland Indians play with such an unbridled passion and a love of that team, and the fact that they lost by a hair to the Chicago Cubs last year is such a shame that, to me, it would only be just if they win it all this year, deservedly so. You know, they haven't had a championship since 1948. They take a lot of flack. But the Indians themselves have always been, to me, a turned-around organization ever since Major League appeared in the theaters. That seemed to spark a whole new interest in these lovable losers.
Right. Well, and I've had a soft spot for them ever since, and this didn't happen terribly far away from where I was living at the time. I think it was 1993 or 94 when that terrible boating accident that took out three of their pitchers preseason and just crippled them. And obviously, it wasn't just the fact that they had a hole in their roster. I mean, how do you come back from that when three of your teammates die?
Well, I remember all too well that night because I was listening to WFAN and they broadcast, you know, breaking news that the boating accident had happened and it killed pitcher Steve Olin almost instantly.
Yep.
Tim Cruz died in the hospital, and that was a breaking report as they were talking about it. And Bob Ojeda, who had just left the Mets, was the other one who was pretty critically injured, and he's the only one who survived it.
Right.
And you know, it hurt. It crippled the Indians, and not just like you said with the hole in the roster, but emotionally it was impossible for them with all the things that people had been saying this team was destined for great things to start happening.
Yeah.
Fortunately, and this is how I spin it, fortunately, 94, the next year, they in fact did make their first playoff appearance in God only knows how many years.
Right.
And the team was in fact on the rise again. Part of it, I think, was because they had a general manager like John Hart, who believed in the whole 5-10 thing with having these young rookies for a long time and having them for long-term deals. You know, players like Charles Nagy on the mound or a young Manny Ramirez or as much of an asshole as he was, Albert Bell.
Yeah.
You know, guys like that were on the roster. They became cornerstones. And he made very wise and inexpensive pickups to Kai and helped tweak the team and shape them up the right way. And they also just moved into Jacobs Field. So, you know, you combine all of that together and that kind of bodes well for a team that you know is on the cusp of something really good.
No doubt. And it's, you know, again, it's good to see it for a number of reasons, not the least of which is it would be nice to see them bounce back one more time from losing to Chicago to come back and win a series. So good for the Indians, man. Go Tribe. And we got to take a little look at what's going on elsewhere in the news because there have been some things that are going on this week that, well, let's start with what happened in London because once again, we have another incident that was almost immediately identified as a terror attack when a bomb went off in the London Underground. And what a, you know, again, a throwback into history. You think about the fact that that was the refuge for the residents of London during the Blitz. And now here we are 70 years later. And where does the attack take place? In the tubes.
And it's not the first time it's happened either.
All right.
And who's culprits behind this?
Well, you know, again, they're being pretty quiet about that, but you know, I think it's what they're doing in London right now. And rightfully so is rounding up the usual suspects.
And was our president wrong in saying another terrorist attack?
No.
Right. I don't think I have anything more to add than that. Being the fact that since London is so England in general is so flip about everything, especially geared towards Americans, and the fact that London's whole embracing the whole love thy enemy kind of thing and having people getting bombed in the subways, well, you know, this is what you get. This is the choice you've made.
Right.
You know, I can't say that I'm completely sympathetic towards England. I don't think I could ever be sympathetic towards England unless they looked at the bigger picture of what they've allowed to happen. You know, England is an incredibly racist country to begin with. You know, I find it ironic that right now, you know, a good portion of the more common folk, or the, if you want to talk England, I guess we have to talk classes. the lower slash working classes are all very anti-Muslim. When a few years ago, and now they're banding up with their fellow citizens who may happen to be black or Pakistani. You know, just a couple of short years ago, I seem to remember them wanting the Wogs and the Pakis to go home.
Right.
You know, they're very good at that kind of thing. And of course, you know, an elderly Jewish couple being beaten by some Polish nationals who happen to be living in London, and all they get on the wrists is a slap because it's only a couple of Jews.
Yeah.
You know, fuck England. I'm sorry. I have no sympathy for them. You get what you deserve.
Right. And at the same time, on the international front, we have, I think it was just this morning, Nikki Haley and H.R. McMaster talking about the military option in North Korea. And it looks like, again, we're skidding headlong toward rekindling this war. And keep in mind, there's no need for Donald Trump to go back to Congress and ask them for any kind of military authorization, because there has been a state of war with North Korea since 1952. It's never ended. There was an armistice that was declared, and that was it. We are still technically at war with them.
It technically never was a war, remember? It was a police action.
Right, right.
Same thing with Vietnam. Neither one were ever declared wars, you know. To me, a police action is, well, St. Louis right now. You know, the thing is, again, I have to side, God help me, with the president. You know, North Korea is making all the overtures towards wanting to go to war with us. They also want to go to war with Japan.
Yep.
You know, and South Korea. It seems to me Kim Jong-un is just biting off a little bit more than he can chew. I'm fairly certain that South Korea and Japan combined could pretty much decimate North Korea together on their own without having to have our help.
The only thing that I want in this is I want assurances from China that they will stay the fuck out.
And, or that they'll leave him themselves because they don't want him fucking with them.
Right, exactly. So it's a terrifying, terrifying prospect, but it's one that got a little bit closer this week because now we have officials in the United States government, and especially somebody who up till now has been as sober as Nikki Haley saying, yep, this could be war. So time to, you know, start keeping track of all of that and really keeping a sharp eye on what's going on. Now, you mentioned St. Louis and that, and the fact is, not to get too much into the weeds in explaining this story, but it's a story that goes back 6 years to 2011, when there was a police officer who shot a black man who was fleeing. He was suspected of dealing heroin, and they had him. I mean, the guy was trying to get out in his car. He backed up, went forward, backed up again, went forward, and hit one of the police officers as he was on his way out. Didn't hit him directly, but nudged him with his car. And the police officer at that point, Stockley is his name, Jason Stockley, fired into the car, missed. Then they chased him. During the chase, Stockley was heard on the dash cam saying, we're going to go kill this motherfucker. And then he did. He shot him and shot him five times. And then there was video evidence of him doing something to manipulate the scene. And the speculation was that he was planting a gun. But there's no confirmation of that. You don't see a gun in his hand. You don't see any of that. And 6 years later, after a couple of different agencies had decided not to prosecute the case, a brand new circuit attorney in St. Louis decided to go ahead with the prosecution, which failed and led to an acquittal on a summary judgment. There was no jury in this trial. It was a judge only. The judge acquitted Jason Stockley on all counts, and then the protests erupted in the street almost immediately, followed by, during the overnight hours, rock and bottle throwing and people throwing paint-filled balloons at the mayor's house. And there were a couple of people injured. There were a couple of... It's nowhere near what it was when the Ferguson incident happened. But it was, again, it was back to that same pattern of behavior. Interestingly, yesterday, a bunch of, a bunch of just everybody. I mean, there was suburban white kids, there were urban black kids, there was everybody there, decided to stage a walkthrough and not a sit-in, but a march through the Frou Frou Mall in West St. Louis County, which happens to be called West County Mall. And what West County Mall has to do with this incident is absolutely nothing other than they wanted to scare the old white ladies in West St. Louis County, which, by the way, they did. So the cops shut down the mall and kicked the protesters out. And it's just, it's gotten to the point where people, I think, are doing things to try to disrupt anything that is seen as status quo in order to further their cause. The problem is, I don't think that furthers their cause. All that does is scare the old white ladies in West St. Louis County even farther into their shells than they already were. So it doesn't seem like anybody's in charge. This isn't like the Montgomery bus boycott, and I think they want it to be. This isn't like the march to Selma, but I think they want it to be. The problem is there's nobody in charge. There's no direction. It's all this social media. It's almost like the flash mob version of protesting. And it just doesn't make any sense. And I fear that, again, even though there are obvious problems here, this isn't going to do anything to solve it. All it's going to do is piss people off and make them go deeper into the same boxes that they were already in.
The kind of protests that you and I have been witness to for the last couple of years, to me, reek of nothing more or less than of the moment, dare I say, flavor of the month.
Yep.
Kind of protests. There's no real altruism or belief in a movement. It's, oh, my friends are going to go protest, I'm going to go join them kind of thing. Or
right.
What you've read on social media and you're suddenly outraged and concerned. And then as soon as it's over, you're back to your usual life.
That's the problem.
A few days ago, a very wise man said, you know, all your rock throwing and bottle throwing achieves what? All your screaming and yelling achieves what? You know, where is the dialogue? Where is the conversation? Where is the construction in all of this?
Right.
And that was you.
Well, and see, the problem is that the next cop who kills somebody is going to be acquitted. And so is the one after him. And so is the one after him. And then there's going to be another mistrial. And then another guy's going to get acquitted. It's not going to change.
You bring up that point because in New York, for the first time ever, and I don't know if the footage made its way to St. Louis, but there's footage from several police body cams of a guy who, about five cops, had trapped in his room, in his apartment. He was an emotionally disturbed person, knife in one hand, and what they thought was a real gun in the other hand. It was a fake gun, but they don't know this.
Right.
You hear them. This is going on for about 7, 8, 10 minutes of them pleading with him, drop the weapons, come with us. Endless. They were told not to taser him, for Christ's sakes.
Right.
He finally made the move with the gun, and they shot him and killed him, which obviously he wanted death by cop. That's first and foremost.
Right.
Second, he was emotionally disturbed. Third, there is no way any of these cops can be considered anything less than doing their job the way they're trained to do when you've got all of that. You've got five different perspectives of it, you know?
Yeah.
They did it by the numbers. But you know that these cops are going – this is where it's come and where it's gone. These cops were there doing their job, are going to get tagged for being racist because he was Hispanic and they were white cops.
Right.
Because apparently the white man is just the devil now. And this is what it's turning into. I don't know who it is who really laid the groundwork for all of this shit, but people want a race war.
Well, yeah, and I mean, sometimes, like in this Stockley case, and I can't say who it is, but I know somebody who is a friend of one of Jason Stockley's brothers. And this person knew him many, many years ago, long before he was a cop, and said he was a racist prick back then. So people don't change. And in some cases, it is that guy. But the problem is that that guy's never going to be convicted. I mean, you look at the Walter Scott case in North Carolina, where you had a cop on video shooting a guy in the back who was running away from him 20
without,
feet away,
without any arms.
Unarmed, and yeah. Then walking over and throwing a weapon down next to him. It was on tape. And that case ended in a mistrial. You and I will never see a cop convicted of something like this, ever.
But yet, for all the cops out there that do their jobs
right
across the board,
yep,
no matter what, they're in a no-win situation.
Exactly. Right.
It is an untenable thing for all of them.
Exactly.
And I don't care if they're black cops, white cops, it doesn't matter. At the end of the day, the police are doing a job that you and I would never have the courage to do, really. Or the, dare I say it, and I'm not trying to be funny, the psychotic tendencies to do, because there are some – listen, I went to high school with several guys who became cops, and I'd have failed their asses. It's kind of like, you know, observe and report. You know what I mean? They were all a bunch of fucking Ronnie Barnhards, you know, but they all became cops. So, you know, oh, yeah, I want to be like Clint Eastwood. Well, no, this isn't like a movie. You see a real gun, you hit the deck, motherfucker.
Right, right.
I mean, the police do an incredible job. I have a great deal of respect and appreciation for the cops. And, you know, I just find the way that they're being painted by the press, and it has nothing to do with these, you know, all cops are pigs assholes, because those assholes are always going to be there.
Right.
But it's the press that continually poison every well possible. The press right now, I don't think most people realize, on the left or the right, the press is our collective enemy. I mean, we're not the press. We're an exception to that.
Right.
We're roving reporters. You know, we are, you know, we are of the people.
I
just happen to be more of some other people than others.
I don't know if I would go quite that far with it. What I would say is that over the last 25 years, the press has become impotent and incompetent, and dangerously so, because when you have somebody who's impotent and incompetent in a job that's as important as that, then all of a sudden you become dangerous. You do become the enemy because you're fucking up the system. And the reason why they've become impotent and incompetent is because the corporations that bought up all of the media properties, and I'm talking about the Gannets and the Viacoms, et cetera, of the world.
News
Corporation, Pulitzer. There's like four or five of them, and they have all of the newspapers and all of the TV stations, and what they did is they started slashing. As soon as they owned them all, they started slashing the numbers of reporters, and they started slashing the pay for the new guys. And what are you going to get? You're going to get the guys who are the worst at it, and the other guys are going to go write books, win Pulitzer Prizes, and get rich. You know, but they're not reporting the news. They're not out there every day doing the reporting that they should be, because that's what they're best at.
Well, I'll tell you something. Certainly in the New York area, reporting here comes down to what they feel like putting in. It's selective reporting.
Yeah.
That's why I look at them as an enemy, because they aren't reporting the facts and the truth as it happened, as it appeared. They're giving you half glimpses.
Yeah. See, that's exactly right. And you look at something like, you always had the paper that was on the liberal slant when it came to the editorials, and the paper that was on the right that had the conservative slant when it came to the editorials. But they always agreed what the facts were.
Right. There's none of that now.
Right.
The New York Times, with its – the New York Times is basically a communist rag now. The New York Post, which is always vile, is the National Enquirer.
Yep.
And the New York Daily News is just nothing.
Right.
It's completely irrelevant, and it's neutered.
Yeah.
It's Staten Island Advance, my local paper, is beyond pathetic. It's less than amateurish. You know, I don't even know what it could be defined as, because they are so behind with the way their writers write, let alone their timing of stories. I don't really need to hear about a local robbery that happened 3 weeks ago. I should have heard about it 3 weeks ago.
Yeah.
Not police are looking for a suspect, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I want to know about the here and now.
Yeah, well, and you know, you're getting to the national scene as far as Donald Trump is concerned at this point. There was a deal made with the Democrats now twice, even though he says the second deal isn't really a deal, the one on DACA, and he's giving in on just about everything. So the great deal maker has abandoned the congressional Republicans and is now getting in bed with the congressional Democrats, which really isn't any better. And what did he do? What was the one thing that he did today that, or not today, but this week, that was perfectly apropos for Donald Trump? He sat Sarah Huckabee Sanders down and put the pretty lady in charge again.
Boy, that's Sarah Huckabee Sanders. You want to talk about an ugly, baggy-eyed galoot. Jesus fucking Christ. I'm sorry, but a friend of mine, I'm paraphrasing here, he said she looks like she's just one chromosome shy of being looking like she's got CP. And that's not disparate to disparage anybody who has CP. They're all fine citizens. She's not. She's somebody who definitely needs to be removed from humanity in general and thrown into a cell somewhere.
Yeah.
What a duplicitous twat when she gets on TV who doesn't know what the fuck she's talking about. You want to talk about dangerous? She's fucking dangerous because of her illiteracy, let alone anything else. But the other thing about, you know, president, my president,
yeah.
If you know, I say that with my tongue very firmly planted in my cheek, he also apparently backed out of the whole, we're coming out of the Paris Accord.
Oh, yeah. Well, and then went back to it again. Late last night, they said, oh, no, we're not backing down. We're still pulling out of the Paris Accord. They can't keep their shit straight for more than an hour.
I'm telling you right now, there's bad hombres on both sides. both on the left and the right.
Yeah, and didn't we need to hear that again?
Well, I'll tell you something. That's the one place where I'm going to stand in firm agreement with our president. Make America great again. MAGA.
Oh, it's so sad. Well, on that happy note, it's time to turn to our In Our Head segment. And this one is all yours, Rob Ross. I love this idea so much.
Not me to steal your thunder. The In Our Head segment is just such a thing of genius because it's the only thing I can think of in my life that makes me actually think on my feet.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they're not, you know, prearranged, pre-rehearsed, pre-discussed. It's every week. You drop it on me as we're about to do it. But because we had so much fun with the stuff we were doing last week, I had a sort of supplemental idea that went along with it. And that is, what are some of the most annoying songs that come to mind, especially from a particular era?
Yeah.
Which era would it be? And name some of those songs.
Well, let's see. Okay, I want to define terms a little bit here because there are two kinds of songs that are annoying. There are songs that are supposed to be annoying, like Barbie Girl was supposed to be an annoying piece of shit of the song. So was the Macarena. So, right, exactly. So are we talking about those or are we talking about songs that really desperately wanted to be taken seriously and still...
Let's go with the latter as opposed to the former, because that's...
That's easy.
And let's look at it this way. You got more of that in the 80s.
Right.
Than you did in the 90s.
And any novelty song, by definition, is going to be annoying, but they're supposed to be, so it's okay. All right, so songs that were supposed to be serious and maybe even became hits and yet are still annoying. From the 80s, the first one that really, and I know I'm going to get it on this one because people just love her to death and... I can take or leave her, but the song Sweet Dreams Are Made of This annoys the piss out of me.
Sweet dreams are made of this. Who am I to disagree? I travel the world and the seven seas. Everybody's looking for something. Some of them want to use you. Some of them want to get used by you.
Song by the Eurythmics so much.
And I can't stand that fucking song. Actually, I don't like the Eurythmics. I'm sorry, I'm not wanting to get on your... I want you to do your thing. It's just that, boy, I can't fucking stand any on it. I never liked the goddamn Eurythmics, save for one fucking song. One song.
Would I lie to you?
Yes.
Yep. You and me both, man. That's the only one of theirs I like.
Fuck the Eurythmics. So I'm glad you said that. Plus, it came out right on the heels of another song that really annoyed the fuck out of me. And if I ever saw the guy who sang it or heard it again, because I heard it and I counted it and I've never forgotten that number, 17 times in one day because it was on every motherfucking radio station in New York. And that's King of Pain. And I'm telling you right now,
oh,
entering a world of fucking pain because Sting Sting, you motherfucker.
Yep.
You and me, I ever see you, there's going to be an incident.
Never been a fan of Bob Seger much either. He's a whiny little bitch as far as I'm concerned, but there are a few songs of his that, even though I don't think they're terrible songs, you know what it is that gets me about Bob Seger is that I picture a bunch of people that I don't like, a bunch of hairy guys who are slamming PBRs, not to be ironic, but because that's all they can afford. You know, this isn't a poor people thing, but still, those hairy dudes who sit there with Mack truck ball caps and get all weepy over Turn the Page, those guys are part of the reason why that vibe bothers me. And whenever I hear the Bob Seger song Down on Main Street, I can't reach the button fast enough.
Okay. I can buy that. I thought you were actually going to say Turn the Page.
Turn the Page does annoy me, but yeah. For some reason that whine, even the guitar in that song is whiny, you know?
I never want to fucking hear what's that fucking song that Tom Yes I'm Gay Cruise dances in his underwear in Risky Business.
Oh, yeah, right. Old Time Rock and Roll.
Yeah, I mean, that's as cornball as you can get.
And there's another one.
Like, Ramblin' Gamblin' Man's a good song. But okay, you know, that's fair. See, you're picking out the whys and wherefores of annoying songs.
And right, and with we talked about this during our One Hit Wonder discussion. During the 70s, Michael Martin Murphy had that terrible Wildfire song. But the one, that's just a bad song. But the one that he followed it up with in 1981... was a song called What's Forever For, that again is just the most maudlin piece of crap of, you know, what's the glory in living? Oh, shut up, Michael Martin Murphy.
Maybe it's me who's gone crazy, but I can't understand why all these lovers keep hurting each other when good love is so hard to come by. So what's the glory in living? Doesn't anybody ever stay together anymore? And if love never lasts forever, tell me what's forever?
Really forgot a major, not only one hit wonder of the 70s, but now we can parlay it into one of the most annoying fucking songs ever. Sometimes When We Touch.
Oh yeah.
The honesty's too much. Wow. You no wonder why Faith Hill divorced your ass.
Yeah, right. Okay? Oh, and you know, Lionel Richie probably bought a lot of property with the royalties that he made from Say You, Say Me. But,
oh, my
but,
God.
But he owes them all to the Beatles because that song is just a warmed-over reworking of a Day in the Life.
That middle part, I've always wanted to beef him senseless for that. I mean, I hate his adopted daughter, Nicole Richie, so that's but I have to forgive him because of Brick House. I mean, that'll always be the...
Right.
Okay, you know what? You're going to get a pass simply because of Brick House.
Yep.
Not for any other reason. If I hear Say You Say Me or Hello,
yeah.
You're getting a beat down. Do you understand?
Yeah. But, you know, and there's a lot of the hair metal stuff that I will give a pass to as well. I mean, there was plenty of annoying shit there, but I'll give a pass to it because at least those guys were having fun.
Right.
I have more of a problem with maudlin than I do with that.
Plus, they weren't out to give you any messages except to have fun,
right?
Get drunk, get high, and get laid.
Right.
That was it.
Yep.
And there's nothing for a good time.
Exactly. And I'm totally fine with that. So, yeah, what are some of yours that just you can't, again, you can't reach the button fast enough?
My number one song of all time, first one on my death list.
Mm-hmm.
And I will find a Peruvian hit squad somewhere, Sunglasses at Night. I fucking hate that song more than I hate Republicans.
Uh-huh.
I'd sooner fuck a Republican woman, and I have, but I would sooner fuck a Republican woman than have to sit through that goddamn song. And Corey Hart should never be allowed to, and he should be shot on sight trying to enter the United States.
Yep.
Okay? You keep him out. You keep him in fucking Canada. Fuck Canada. You know what? Blame Canada. And I do. I agree with Sheila Bruslovsky. Okay? So that's one. We just mentioned Sometimes When We Touch, because that song always gave me the douche chills.
Yep.
Torn Between Two Lovers.
And he knows he can't possess me. And he knows he never will. There's just this empty place inside of me that only he can fill. Torn between two lovers, feeling like a fool. Loving both.
God, do I want to fucking punch that woman out. See, I'm an equal opportunity. I hate every one of these people.
Yep.
And want to hurt them for being stupid enough to sing these fucking songs and show themselves on TV.
Yeah.
I want to cause them all incredible amounts of pain. When the Going Gets Tough by Billy Ocean.
Or really anything by Billy Ocean.
That's true. Caribbean Queen was bad enough.
Yeah.
And Suddenly was bad enough. But The Going Gets Tough, forget it. You need a fucking beat down also.
Right.
These are songs not only that are just annoying, but you should be beaten down for them.
Yeah. Well,
there's no excuse for any of this.
Now, I have to give an honorable mention to Sade, because even though I think she has a lovely voice, I mean, it's not my style of music at all, but Coast to Coast, L.A. to Chicago? Can somebody get this fucking lady a map?
Something, something, down Key Largo.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah,
but she's so gorgeous, and she's got such an incredible voice.
Yeah.
That gets me worked up to the nth degree.
Well, yeah, and
I'll give her a pass anytime.
Right. Now, you said the words Key Largo, which brings us right to Bertie Higgins. Because fuck that guy.
We had it all. Just like Bogey and Bacall. Starring in our own late, late show. Sailing away to Key Largo. Here's looking at you, kid. Missing all the things we did. We can find it once again. Hello. Just like they did in Key Largo.
Yeah, no question. And you know what? As much as people find it cutesy and kind of kitschy now, fuck Rupert Holmes too.
Oh yeah.
Venus coladas.
Uh-huh.
And getting caught in the rain. And if I found out my bitch was ever, you know, writing a fucking ad and hitting me up on it, when I find her, I'm going to beat her down. That's what all men do.
Yeah.
Because it was the 70s and we kept our pimp hands strong.
Yeah. I feel like there was one that, while we were brainstorming this, that we both came up with independent of each other. And now I can't for the life of me remember what it was.
Oh, these songs float in and out of our heads like there's no tomorrow. I mean, yeah. There were songs from the 60s that, you know, there used to be a point where some of them just really annoyed the shit out of me.
Uh-huh.
And now, oh, I got one for you. Did we talk about it in last week's show of One Hit Wonders, but also equally annoying? Playground in My Mind.
No, we should have.
Remember that fucking annoyance of a song? Fucking
yep.
Clint Holmes. God, talk about a kid touchers kind of song. That was always creepy.
Oh, and while I said I will give hair metal a pass for a lot of things, one of those things is not Night Ranger's Sister Christian.
Okay, before you say anything further, you have to remember something. Our brethren at Pop Dose all have major erections over, you know, Night Ranger.
Okay.
You are the only exceptions to the rule, but that's because we know better. We're right. Also older than them. I give them the pass because they're kids.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Let the kids have their fun. But fucking Night Ranger. Night Ranger, Mr.
Uh-huh.
Fuck all of them. Because, fuck you, that's why.
And of all the Bon Jovi songs, because all of them annoy me.
Jesus in the Runaway sucks the most.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, when it got to the point where he became megastar John Bon Jovi, what the hell is the one about Johnny used to work on the docks and all of that?
I didn't even fucking know because I got away from all of that.
But the
no idea.
I mean, you hand a guy. Richie Sambora is a fairly talented guy. I mean, he's not an amazing guitar player, but he's a fairly talented guy. And you hand him a talk box, which, I mean, let's talk about Joe Walsh. Let's talk about Peter Frampton. Let's talk
about that Uba, 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 Uba song, is it?
Yeah, and all they do, all he does with the talk box is go, whoa, whoa, whoa. Whoa, whoa, whoa. How fucking original and unique. I mean,
that's all Bruce never does in every one of his songs, you know. No, it works down at the refinery. Whoa, whoa, whoa.
Yeah, and by the way, when exactly did Bruce Springsteen get his jaw wired shut? I was always curious about that.
When did Bruce Springsteen get a Southern accent is what I want to know. I mean, I'm sorry, South Jersey ain't down below the Mason-Dixon line.
Absolutely.
If
yeah.
you're from Freehold, you should pretty much sound like every other jackass from Freehold. I know a lot of jackasses from Freehold. I dated a jackass from Freehold. Mm-hmm. But the point is they all sound alike, and they don't sound like Springsteen. You know, the boss sounds like he's from you know, down in Georgia or something like that.
not somewhere in the swamps of Jersey. So on the 1970s annoyance scale, which one in your mind weighs the scale down farther? Alone Again Naturally or Seasons in the Sun? Because
if I had to pick one over the other, because I don't hate either song, yeah. I actually love Seasons in the Sun. that's one of my favorite singles of the 70s. Now, I hated Terry Jack's previous incarnation with the Poppy Family. Which Way You Going, Billy?
Oh, yeah, right.
That's fucking limp-wristed, lame-brained. That's as bad as Put Your Hand in the Hand of the Man Who Spilled the Water.
Uh-huh.
Remember Ocean?
Uh-huh.
What's the other one? What's another one? But Gilbert O'Sullivan, I can... take or leave him. You know, I don't really care.
But the one that I just cannot listen to is "Cherish" by The Association. I just can't.
I used to sing funny lyrics to that. Like, I don't know how many times I wanted to wring your scrawny neck. Whereas, yet they did one song that some of those songs I really like because of the vocal arrangement. Certainly, "Along Comes Mary" is a badass.
Oh
one.
Yeah. Definitely. I don't hate The Association. I just hate that song.
Everything That Touches You is magnificence.
Yep.
Personified. That song is just so beyond description of perfection. But yeah, Cherish is just kind of twee and limp-wristed also.
Yep.
But hey, there are some songs that really annoy the fuck out of me. Like, I'll start giving you this a quick list. Hey Jude, I can't listen to that fucking song.
Yeah.
Yeah, that song just goes on and on forever. I can't fucking listen to it. I never want to hear Imagine for the rest of my fucking life because I can't stand that goddamn song. Okay? Yeah, imagine this. Imagine you weren't so full of shit, you fucking wealthy, two-faced hippie scumbag.
Right. Imagine me snapping the radio off.
You wretched fucking commie. Let's see. Other classics that just annoy the shit. Daddy, Don't You Walk So Fast by Wayne Newton. Oh, I wanted to punch the shit out of him for that. That's an annoying goddamn song. See, these are big hits when we were kids.
Right.
You know, when we were in that 6 or 7 year old range that on our little AM radios, we would just snap off and go, ugh, you know. But our mothers would be dumb enough to buy from the one penny 12 albums from the Columbia Record Club thing, thinking you're going to find a gem amongst the single that was on that album.
Yeah.
No, you're not.
Right.
You're not going to find anything of remote validity. You know, these songs, look, we've touched on it before, but Heiress 2 by Mo Sidatis was really fucking irksome. I hated the Lord's Prayer.
Oh, yeah, the singing nuns version?
No. That was Dominica in the 60s. No, this was Sister Mary something or other.
Uh-huh.
It was like this rockin' version of the Lord's Prayer, which just irritated the fuck. First of all, not being a Catholic, that gave me a pass right away. I'm like, jeez, Glenn, I'm not Christian.
And neither, by the way, is Norman Greenbaum, but that's another story.
Well, haven't we all learned that the best songs written about Christ were all written by the Jews?
Yeah, right. I mean, the whole Jesus Christ Superstar was written by a Jew, so,
you know, most good songwriters are all Jews. Lieber and Stoller, you know, Goffin and King,
yep.
Man Weill, Carol Bayer Sager, and Burt Bacharach. Me.
Yeah.
It's like a, you know, a generational list. Neil Diamond. Come on.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, then you see.
God, one of the most annoying fucking songs on the planet, You Don't Bring Me Flowers.
Uh huh.
And America. Neil, you were once my hero, but you lost me with those two. You lost me and then you never got me back.
Yeah.
And I don't care if you bring me flowers and I don't want to talk to you when you come through the door at the end of the day. You wrote Coming to America. Fuck yeah. You.
Not to mention the song you wrote about E.T. Turn on Your Heart Light. Remember that one?
You ready? Sorry, I already sat shiver for him after. Nope. You know what's another fucking annoying song that's unpardonable? Going back to the 70s? I'm sorry, I'm going for this one. I Was Made for Loving You by You Know Who.
Oh.
That, you know, they were losing me, and the solo albums, I'm starting to fall right off the edge of the cliff.
Yep.
Once Dynasty came out with I Was Made for Loving You, you did the one thing you were not allowed to do that you should have never done. You did a disco record. And I don't care that 2000 Man is one of the best things you ever did by A, letting A sing lead and B, covering the Stones. I don't care. And Sure Knew Something may be a great song. You did a disco song.
Yeah.
And I'm not forgiving you. You're dead to me. Do you understand me? Dead to me. Now I got to turn my back on you.
Well, we've got that. See, this is why we have the comment section. And I'll tell you, after this, I am looking forward to seeing what else is in the comment section after this is out there in front of the public and we have a chance to hand it to you and ask you for your annoying song. So please.
Well, I got a couple more because I'm not done yet. You opened Pandora's box.
Oh, hit it.
Pooch.
By all means.
Talking about the king himself, we're talking about Paul McCartney.
Yeah.
Okay. There's no fucking way I'm ever forgiving Ebony and Ivory.
Say.
Fuck you, Paul. Okay. No more lonely nights. No more shitty songs. Please, Paul. Or those atrocities like the remakes of For No One and Eleanor Rigby. How dare you?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know what? It's a good thing you're dead.
You know,
and this is just your fucking imposter doing these songs, because the real Paul would absolutely be spinning in his grave.
Did you see Broad Street in the theater like I did?
Yeah.
Yep.
But I drank a lot back then as a teenager. It was, you know, it was excusable.
Yep.
You know what I mean? Oh, my God. I mean, Paul McCartney, really, he's another fucking guy who should. I just called to say I love you. Stevie, you just committed career suicide.
Uh-huh.
You know, see, the thing is, the 80s, I truly believe, were the decade of annoying songs, because I love the fact that you brought up the distinction. Songs that were meant to be annoying,
mm-hmm.
like a shitty song like Barbie Girl or Smells Like Teen Spirit,
yep.
or anything off of 10 or Verses.
Mbop.
Mbop, correct. I mean, 94, 5, 6 were definitely those 3 years where you were going to get a ton of shitty songs that were going to be definitive one-hit wonders. You know, Steal My Sunshine.
although I have a special place in my heart for that song.
Because of the more things, sure. Yeah. But we're never going to listen to those songs or hear. We're not going to think about those songs 30 years from now. 30 years after the fact, and we're still pissed off about things like No More Lonely Nights, or I Just Called to Say I Love You, you know?
Some guys have all the luck.
Yeah, you know what? Some guys also get caught with a lot of jizz in their stomach. You know what I mean? Like, fuck you, Rod. Go away. Without the faces, you ain't shit,
yep.
Okay? Who else? I mean, I had one, but you picked the Rod Stewart one. So that you know, look. I ain't forgiven Elton John for real shit like I'm Still Standing. That, to me, that's when I said, you're dead to me. When I do one of these, that means either cut to commercial or you're dead to me. So you can't see it because we're on the radio, but, you know, I'm making the slashing motion across the throat. You know, people who I just absolutely love putting out absolute trash in the 80s. You know, there were some songs that, you know, had a laughable quality. I didn't love the fact that Bow Wow Wow, who was a band I actually kind of liked, did a song as bad as I Want Candy. It's fine for the Strange Loves, but you know, the fact that Bow Wow Wow was doing it just was cheesy.
Yeah.
But it wasn't annoying. It's catchy.
Right.
You know, it's a catchy song.
Not to mention I was 14, too, and she was hot.
Well, beautiful woman. I mean, she's magnificent looking and a very sweet woman at that.
Good.
But the thing is, then you go and you know, they're, oh, Jesus, I mean, you know, what's that fucking song, The Way by Fastball? What's
oh,
that?
Yeah.
That's one of those, when you say it like that, with the guttural feel, I am presuming that at the same time a gas attack happens, because this is what these songs emote. And the 80s, unfortunately, however, were the decade that was prevalent for this shit. We picked a whole bunch of them out last week that to me were annoying, but they were the one-hit wonders. Fucking Quarter Flash.
You know? Yeah.
Quarter Flash. You hated Quarter Flash. Anyone with a half a brain hates Quarter Flash.
Harden My Heart is I
suck the dick is more like it. Okay, that's no.
Yep.
No. You know, shitty stuff from the early 80s. Frankie and the Knockouts, you know? Crap like that. Early 80s garbage. And I mean absolute garbage. You know,
What was the other Quarter Flash song? Because it was a piece of shit, too.
I know what you're thinking of. I know the song that you're thinking of. I just can't really remember the name of it, which is fine, because we shouldn't remember names of songs that really suck a huge moose dick.
Yep.
You know, look, there are bands that we like that kind of, you know, you kind of scratch your head. Like, I like Jay Giles' band. Love Stinks is one thing, but Playboy's Essential is another. And I'm sorry, Peter Wolf's solo, Dancing in the Dark. Dude, you should have called Springsteen first, because he already beat you to it.
Yeah.
You know?
Find Another Fool was the other Quarter Flash.
Thank you. All right, you know what really irked the shit out of me? Because the song that you and I picked as being a great foreign language song was the English version of Der Kommissar. That was just an atrocity. After the fire, fuck you. Go away and don't ever come back. Don't ever show your face here ever, ever again. You know, Don't Forget Me When I'm Gone by Glass Tiger. Yeah, one hit, but you're really fucking annoying. And yeah, I'm going to forget you.
Right.
You know. Also, Tiffany, I'm sorry, in the whole Tiffany versus Debbie Gibson thing, there's no contest.
Oh,
first
yeah.
Of all.
Well, Debbie Gibson wrote music.
Tiffany having the audacity to do I Think We're Alone Now, and I saw her standing there.
Yeah.
Ew. Ew. Oh my God, that's just so ew.
Go back to the mall.
And stay there.
Yep.
Go back to your little mall kiosk, because obviously you weren't good enough to work in one of the stores. You weren't good enough for the Gap. Or even Spencer's, okay? You're just going to work in a little cart in front of them.
That's right. And you can be ogled by the guy who works at the store selling the Baldwin organs. Which, by the way, did anybody ever go to the mall and buy a fucking Baldwin organ ever?
My parents almost did.
Did they really?
They almost bought a Wurlitzer because, you know, I wanted to play organ. But the thing is, I wanted a fucking Vox organ.
Right.
Since we couldn't find one, they said, well, we'll get you a Wurlitzer. No.
Yep.
I don't want to be sitting here playing, you know, Take Me Out to the Ball Game.
Well,
the build-up fanfare, yep.
Well, I think we've got all the annoyance we can take at this point. And again, leave us more. Leave them in the comment section. We would love to read your list. And
thank you. Because you've had to live with it, so you have to as well.
There you go. And it doesn't matter if everybody else likes it. If it annoys you, that's good enough. Leave it for us. And we're going to leave it at that. Rob Ross, thank you again. And we'll talk to you next week, buddy.
All right, brother. Have a good one.